This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome, heroes and villains, to another super episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me, as per usual, is my friend, my co-pilot, screenwriter, slash novelist, yes, slash lieutenant in Megaforce, before you say anything, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
All that pomp and circumstance, all that sound and fury. For high.
Hi.
Well, I want to remind you guys that you can catch us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you're on iTunes, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? Or if you don't like us, you know, still leave a review. I'll read them. I don't care. But I would like us to move up the ranks a little bit in iTunes and get a few more ears listening in on this show. So if you enjoy it, please go there and let us know why. And definitely hit us up on Twitter. I think we're pretty good about talking to our listeners on Twitter and fielding your suggestions. I will tell you straight up that last month, one of the movies we did was completely suggested by a listener, and I just loved the idea so much that we totally did Punisher Warzone. So awesome. Keep doing that, guys. We really do appreciate that. Also, if you're going to be in the Minneapolis area on July 3rd, Cargill and I will be doing a live version of the show at Convergence there in Minneapolis, and we're very excited about that. But if you're not going to be there, just keep watching our Twitter feed. We will let you know if we're going to be doing that live, maybe via Ustream. Who knows? Crazy things can happen. Well, we're continuing, what do we call this? The Junk Food Cinema Summer School.
It's the JFC Summer School.
JFC Summer School. And this week,
we continue and finish off the last of these three films, which are teen films, which are not only really great in and of themselves, but prominently feature a really talented cast of people who would go on to be pretty big in their own right.
And not only that, but another film that, though a contemporary teen film, owes a lot of its existence to 80s teen films, and that's evident all over this one. However,
and it owes itself to 60s teen films.
That is also true. This is probably the most interesting of the lot so far, because in doing all of that, it is also smashing up against the superhero genre.
Yeah, and it's got Kurt fucking Russell.
And it has Kurt fucking Russell.
Who is, if there was ever a patron saint of this show, it would be Kurt Russell.
It would probably be Kurt Russell. Yeah. Yeah, more than likely. And we are, of course, talking about 2005's Sky High.
Welcome to Sky High. You are the descendants of the world's most legendary superheroes.
All he wants is to live up to his family name.
My parents are the greatest superheroes on the planet.
But he's not sure he's got what it takes.
A film that I have loved since I saw the advanced screening of. This is one of those films that me and a bunch of critics pimped and never quite caught on, but is one of those that we have passed around for years as just a really great teen film, a really great superhero film, a film that gets everything right.
Yeah. This is, for me, just personally, probably the most surprising film in terms of expectation versus result. Because I remember how I saw this movie. I had a summer job watching these kids, and I took them to the movies because this is what was playing. And my expectation was, I'm going to have to suffer through this. I love Kurt Russell, but this looks, whatever, it's a Disney movie. They've been watching the Disney Channel every day, and the shows that were on at the time, I wanted to hang myself, because I kind of had to tertiarily watch them as well.
But Brian, hanging yourself, that's so Raven.
You know what? Let me just say I did not live a sweet life at this time, and I was neither Zach nor Cody.
At Waverly Place?
For fuck's sake. Enough. Yes, we have a knowledge of these shows, and that's terrifying, and we've proven that. But I ended up really loving this movie because it was nothing that I expected.
It's so good.
Yeah.
It's so fucking good. Everything it tries to do, it hits. And the thing is it it seems to be setting a low bar with everything, and then it leaps over the fucking bar. Like, even
in a single bound, you might say.
Yeah, in even the most crass and juvenile of jokes work because they've assembled such an amazing cast. Like, there's one joke at the end of this movie that, if done by almost anyone else, wouldn't work. And yet, because they brought two characters in from the kids in the hall to play two of the teachers,
yeah,
you have Mr. Medulla going, who's been turned into a baby, looking up and going,
"Regrettably, I have made boom boom."
And then looking right into the camera and smiling in such a way that you're like, all right, that's juvenile as fuck, but I'm laughing.
Yeah.
Fuck you, you're making me laugh at a poop joke, but I'm fucking laughing at a goddamn poop joke. And because it's executed by a comedy master, you know, the kids in the hall were fucking brilliant. And here we have two of the kids in the hall together doing, and in fact, given screen time together. And then the rest of the cast, you know, they knew exactly who they were casting for the teachers at the school and for the adults, and they cast wonderfully. And then they cast all these really talented young kids, some who would go on to hit later, some who would not, some who would be given the chance to hit and would not.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because Disney definitely expected this movie to be bigger than it was. They apparently, there are actors that have come forward and said, yeah, our contract for this movie stipulated that we would not only be available for sequels, but for the inevitable TV show that was going to follow this. And none of those things happened, which I think is a fucking crime. Because this movie, first of all, here's the basic premise. If you don't know what we're talking about, Sky High is a movie about a secret high school that is for the children of superheroes. Or, well, not even necessarily.
No. It's
like Hogwarts for superheroes, essentially. It's school where
you're
going to be taught how to use your superpowers so that you can become an effective superhero yourself.
Unless you have shitty superpowers or no superpowers.
In which case,
you're a sidekick.
You are assigned.
Sidekick!
Sidekick. Yeah, by the way. You mentioned the cast. The cast in this movie is redonkulous.
Right, I mean, the principal of Superhero High is Linda Carter, fucking Wonder Woman.
Fucking Wonder Woman, who has a great line. They skirt that so well through most of the movie, and then she has this great line as she's walking out of detention at one point and says, "I'm not Wonder Woman, you know." But it's just so thrown away perfectly so that it's not mugging, and it's not treacly. It just works so well. One of the things I did learn is that she was initially going to be wearing gold bracelets the whole time. But the thing is, Wonder Woman, Warner Brothers owns the copyright to her. So even though they had the actress who played Wonder Woman on TV, even though they make a reference to Wonder Woman, she can't legally be Wonder Woman in a Disney movie.
No,
so they couldn't do that. But I think it's funny that they did sneak in that one, "I'm not Wonder Woman, you know" line.
Of course, the gym teacher.
Bruce Campbell.
Yes.
As Boomer.
Boomer. And then you've got, as I mentioned before, Dave Foley and
Kevin McDonald.
Yeah, Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall, both playing teachers. One without powers, who is the lead teacher of the sidekick track. And then the other, Mr. Medulla, who is the mad scientist science teacher.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, just, of course, bus driver.
Stan Wilson, bus driver.
Yeah.
Hi, Stan Wilson.
Played by
Kevin Heffernan
from,
it's Ron Wilson, bus driver.
Played by Kevin Heffernan from,
the Broken Lizard movies. Yeah, absolutely.
No, like all of these, there's all of these great support adults in there.
Cloris Leachman as the school nurse.
Oh yeah. And then of course you've got, finally, as we talked about, Kurt Russell and
Kelly Preston
as mom and dad, two of the greatest heroes in the world. And this is what leads up to our main drama, which is really great. Essentially what it is we have the kid who is the son of Earth's two greatest heroes.
The Commander and Jetstream, played by Kurt Russell and Kelly Preston.
Who are married and madly in love and wonderful superheroes. And so everyone expects great things of him. He is a dynasty kid, and he shows up to school and he doesn't have any powers.
He hasn't gotten his powers yet. He doesn't know what they are and
may not get them.
And may not at all.
And so he ends up on the sidekick track, hanging out with all the loser kids, and his best friend, who has a great power and should be a hero, but doesn't believe in labels, so ends up in the sidekick track because she's a hipster kid.
Actively rejecting the caste system that is so important for every teen high school movie.
Exactly, as we talked about last week. Yeah. You know, this is something, this, and all of the reason these three films, we've talked about these three films together, is because they all share synergies with one another. They all have these really great young casts that went on to do amazing things. They all have survived the test of time and all are great films. They all are hearkening back to the perfection of teen films. And they all are films about struggling with the caste system, you know, about these characters trying to exist within high school. And they all have these inner truths.
Mm-hmm.
Our fourth movie was also going to kind of be that exact same thing, but we called an audible.
We did.
And ended up with something else. We were going to talk. Our fourth movie was going to be Tough Turf.
Yeah.
Which talk about also an amazing young cast. And a film that holds up, but then you realize that, hey, this is the perfect time to slot in a canon film.
Yep.
And yeah, talk about
The Last American Virgin. Yeah.
Which does not share as much in common. So we're going to veer off this course. So I figured we would tie up our little trilogy here.
That was exactly what I was thinking, is that Last American Virgin is so different from these three films that it'll be a nice, like, and then there's this other route you could take. But as far as the caste system in high school, this high school really only has three. You have heroes, you have sidekicks, and War and Peace. Like, those are three caste systems.
Heroes, sidekicks, and villains.
Well, yeah.
Because you have a bunch of the people who are in the hero track, but they're the cool kids, and they're also the fucking bullies and villains.
Right, yeah. But, and then you have War and Peace, who everyone thinks is going to be a villain because his dad was a super villain,
Yes. Which
I think is a really interesting twist on that, because he's still allowed to go to Sky High and be his own person, even though his father is a villain who Will Stronghold, our hero, his father, played by Kurt Russell, put away into prison. So they immediately don't like each other.
Yeah, except his mother is apparently a hero.
Is that right?
I believe that they mentioned that his mother's a hero and his father's a villain.
Huh.
And but that's why he goes to Sky High. But Sky High doesn't delineate. You know, it's all about teaching everyone to be heroes. But then we have, so we've talked about the adult cast. The young cast is so great. There are a couple of really super talented people who came out of this.
One of which being this girl you may know named Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
Who, yes.
So pretty. Oh my gosh.
Yes. And a fantastic actress, and who would go on to play a number of great roles. Do another teen film that is in kind of the same superhero comic book vein in Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yep.
And then would, of course, go on to do, you know, she you know, would do Quentin Tarantino's worst movie and one of the worst.
First of all, Kurt Russell is also in that movie.
Yes.
And secondly, unfairly maligned film, in my opinion. Still, I like Death Proof a lot.
As unfairly maligned as it may be, is it not Tarantino's least film?
Well, that's like saying which of the new Marvel movies is the worst. It's like, man, you are like, you're.
No. The answer is Thor 2.
Right. But Thor 2 is not a bad movie. It's just not as good as the other great movie. Like, that's all I'm saying. I'm saying that the company, I would gladly be, you know, I think
the worst Tarantino film is still pretty great.
On his worst day, Tarantino is better than most filmmakers on their best day. That's all I'm going to say.
She, you know, had a couple of missteps. I would even throw in The Thing in there.
Mm-hmm.
The unnecessary remake prequel that seemed like it was going to be kind of cool, but then it ended up not.
Yeah.
Mary
Elizabeth Winstead plays a character named Gwen Grayson, who is a combination. Her name is a combination of course, Gwen Stacy and Dick Grayson.
Yes.
Which I thought was really cool. And she has a very interesting character arc in this movie that I think is, I don't know if it's really that surprising. Like, I don't know if it's like completely out of nowhere. But it's played really well. And I really like sort of the epic legacy type storytelling that's going on with that type of character. Also, someone I didn't even know was in this movie until the most recent time I watched it.
Oh, I know exactly who you're going to say. Jim Rash.
Jim Rash.
Academy Award winner Jim Rash, that you guys know as the Dean on Community.
Yeah.
Plays the father of Gwen Grayson / evil sidekick.
The evil little, like, chattering Harlequin-looking guy. And then Royal Payne's voice is Patrick Warburton.
Yeah. So
people turn up everywhere in this movie, whether you recognize them or not, whether they're on screen or not.
And of course, then there's, you know, the Michael Angarano, who is one of those guys who's really kind of struggled because he was really hot in Hollywood for a while. Played a lot of the young guy roles, was really good, really likable, but still has a baby face and is trying to escape that whole baby face thing. And he's kind of suffering from Ralph Macchio syndrome of everybody still thinks of him as that cute young guy. And he's trying to destroy that image and move on to become an adult actor. And then, of course, there's the gorgeous Danielle Pennebaker, mm-hmm. who has since moved on to another superhero thing. She's in The Flash right now. Those of you who are in love with The Flash are like, oh, Danielle Pennebaker, who's done a lot of great stuff. I'm a big fan of her portion of a specific film that is one of those rare films that's half good, half bad.
Which is
Mr. Brooks.
Which
half of everything with her and
Kevin Costner
is fucking fantastic. Everything with the cop, Demi Moore, is not fantastic. It's really, really bad.
She's also in two films, one of which is a Junk Food Cinema alum, The Crazies.
The Crazies,
and
yes.
One which, in my opinion, could easily be a Junk Food Cinema alum, and that's the remake of Friday the 13th, which I legit adore.
We both legit adore. Yeah. It's like really hip to hate on the remake of that, but that movie was a lot of fun, and yeah, she's in it. And she's really great. You know, unfortunately, she was in Piranha 3 Double D.
Yeah,
friends who wrote a version of Piranha 3 Double D love to kick themselves in the balls over. It's a movie that even the people that made Piranha 3 Double D are just kind of like, yeah, that was a thing that we were involved with. We remember that, and we're sorry.
That happened. Our sincere apologies.
I love that Patrick and Marcus will just show up on social media every once in a while drinking beers from, like, Piranha 3 Double D koozies. without irony. They're just like, fuck it.
I find it very odd that two of the members of this young cast were both in Red State.
Oh, yeah.
That's really odd to me. I did not know that. That's a little strange. There is a pretty outstanding cast all the way around here. And I think that's one of the great strengths of this movie, is as strong as the established, adult actors are in this movie, all of the young talent in this movie is fantastic. And here's a great tribute, a great testament to how good this cast is. The actor who plays Speed, who's one of the bullies and who has his superpower is super speed, is an actor named Will Harris. They wrote that role for an actor who would be, very well built and slim and, the kind of character you would associate, like somebody who looked more like Barry Allen, who you would associate with being a speedster.
Yeah.
And even though he's overweight, he was so good in the audition, they were like, oh, we don't even fucking care. You're Speed. You are going to be the guy with super speed. We don't care what you look like because you just killed this audition. So I think that's a great testament to how good this young cast is.
Yeah, no, there's so much talent around, and it's so likable that it's really... And it really gets all the beats right. And I think that's one of the things, is it hits... The story is very trope built. Mm-hmm. Like, it is very much built on tropes. Like, it is beat for beat a standard Hollywood teen film. It doesn't have a lot of surprises thrown in. There are twists, but they're exactly where the twist should be. It is a very, very carefully structured movie that is very much Save the Cat. Like, it is beat for beat the Save the Cat structure. But the performances and the way they combine the tropes of superhero movies with the tropes of high school movies really, really fucking works.
Yeah.
One of the best parts of this is the relationship between our hero, Will Stronghold, and War and Peace, who you really, by the time you get to the beginning of the third act of this movie, you really want to see these two hang out. And my, as I've talked about before, my favorite moment in any film, in any, if you want to get me clapping like a kid on fucking ice cream day, you give me a movie where you have two people that absolutely hate or fear each other, that just don't get along, that the whole movie seems to be set up to fight one another, and you're just waiting for the big fight, and instead of the big fight, what you get is a moment where they totally grok each other, and they're like, dude, we're on the same side, and it's like, fuck yeah, high five, Tango and Cash, baby, fuck yeah, and this movie has it so good. By the time these guys who have fought, and these guys who are supposed to be arch nemeses are on the same side, you're like, fuck yeah, War and Peace, of course you and Will Stronghold are gonna be heroes together, yeah!
Yeah.
And it's fucking great.
And they concoct a really great arena for that moment, or at least the start of that moment, in the Save the Citizen game that they play in this movie, which is so much fun to watch, where two students will play the part of villains trying to stop the heroes from saving a mannequin that's being suspended over razor blades. And it's just like, it's basically a workout, you know, for the heroes. And the two of them have to go against the two bullies.
Stretch and Speed.
Yeah, Lash and Speed.
Lash and Speed.
Who one of them has super stretch abilities like Mr. Fantastic. And then Speed, obviously, is just, again, just super speed. But the two of them having to play that game together and the way that they pull that off is so much fun to watch. And it's very much that kind of moment where it's like, yeah, fuck yeah. And it's the beginning of them starting to understand one another. And I also love the fact that his name is Warren Peace. It's a pun, and yes. I like it.
Well, yes, but it's a superhero pun in the way that... Because that's the thing, is this movie is not... It does not fit in stylistically with the type of superhero movies that we're seeing today. It's not of the Marvelverse. It's not of the Zack Snyder DC verse. It is very much having fun with superhero movies of like the 60s and 70s.
Well, if you think about it, this came out in 2005, a month after Batman Begins. So we are still very, very early in the sort of superhero renaissance.
No, we are. We're in the phase where Hollywood realized that these movies weren't so silly anymore and could be serious, and they could make money. The X-Men and X-Men movies and Spider-Man movies had convinced everyone, holy shit, like, this is a legit thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't where it was now, where all of a sudden Marvel calls up Oscar winners and goes, we have a superhero movie for you, Tilda Swinton. And the answer is, oh, yes, let me take your call. It was still kind of the, superhero movies are not my thing era. And so you were getting... It was still a mixed bag, and there were several that came out that did not work.
They went for superhero movies.
There were a lot of bad superhero movies in this era. Like, this era is the era of shit.
Of, like, Ang Lee's Hulk, for example.
Of the original Punisher before Warzone. Of Catwoman.
Yeah.
Of Elektra.
Yeah.
Of Daredevil before we got the Daredevil director's cut.
Yeah.
I actually like the director's cut.
Yeah, I'm going to argue that movie still sucks even as a director's cut, but maybe it's slightly less bad. I don't know. But I will say that, yeah, this was before... 2008 was the year that Marvel like started putting its dick on the table and going, no, we're going to take back these characters and make them serious and show you that you can do these movies that have more of a serious bent to them, that can make money, can still be fun.
Before the Feigeverse happened.
But yeah, exactly. So this is... But I still...
Feigeverse!
Feigeverse. I feel bad for Sky High because I feel like it had the unfortunate luck of coming out a month after Batman Begins. So maybe... I don't know, maybe that's part of the reason it didn't catch on with audiences, because they were starting to realize that, you know, between, like Cargill said, the X-Men movies, the Spider-Man movies, that there was something different going on with superhero films. But what I love a lot about Sky High is how much it rips on superhero tropes. Take movies out of the equation entirely. Just tropes from, like, comic books that I think is fantastic. One of my favorite moments in the movie. It's such a small thing. So Layla is Will Stronghold's best friend. They've been friends for years. She comes over, you know, the morning of their first day at Sky High, and she's there with his father, and she refers to his father is in his what do you call it? His alter ego attire as a real estate agent.
Yes.
But he's not wearing his glasses. And Layla says, good morning, Commander. And he's like, whoa, why'd you call me Commander? And she points to his eyes like, oh, thank you. And he puts on the glasses. In other words, making fun of that Superman trope where when he's got the glasses on, no one recognizes him as Superman. It's just Clark Kent. That's the one thing dividing the two sides of his personality is a pair of fucking spectacles. And I thought that was hilarious. I also love the fact that Dave Foley's character, who is like the Robin of years past, like his name is Mr. Boy.
Yes.
He's Mr. That is the character's name. And you see him teaching the sidekicks about picking colors that don't clash with the superheroes.
Yes.
Which is a reference to Batman and Robin in the comic books. Robin wearing yellow and green next to Batman's blue and gray and black. And then he also teaches them, he writes it on the board, holy blank.
But yeah.
It's like they're doing a lesson on how
holy
to form.
Holy blank, blank, blank.
And they're making fun of it all the time. Like just, you know, like one of the, like. Every kid in this movie wears his or own color scheme throughout the entire movie. Like, their clothes always have the same colors. Like, for example, Layla's is green, Gwen's is pink, Warren's is red and black, Zach's is yellow, Magenta's is purple, Ethan's is orange. And throughout the whole movie, and Will obviously is red, white, and blue, no matter what they're wearing, it's always that color scheme.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just funny to me. I thought it was like, they're just like picking apart comic book tropes, really.
And doing a great job with it.
Yeah.
You know who we haven't talked about, who I would like to talk about? We mentioned him in passing. Stephen Strait.
Yes.
Who plays War and Peace. Talk about guys who got a bum fucking deal. This guy, he's great here. He's so great here. He plays War and Peace. He's so likable. He's so badass. He would then go on to be in two of the very worst movies of the 2000s, two of my favorite worst movies of the 2000s. Both two of the most ludicrously bad movies. Now, of course, somebody's going, he wasn't in the core, but not the core, because the core is one of them. But if there were two other movies from this decade, they would be The Covenant.
The Brovenant, yeah.
And The Brovenant. Oh my God, do I love The Covenant. The Covenant.
You do love that movie.
I love the shit. It is so bad. It is pure irony love for that movie. It is. There is nothing good about that movie at all. It's that everything is so bad in that movie that it is amazing. Like, the dialogue is just like, fuck Harry Potter and, oh my God, I'm going to make you my weeoch. I forgot about that line. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Oh my God. Oh my God. We have to do an episode of The Covenant.
I guess we do.
And then, of course, 10,000 BC, the movie that makes no fucking sense whatsoever. Like, it feels at first like it's making sense, and then it says, fuck sense. We're making a big movie here.
Yeah.
And it is the Roland Emmerich style filmmaking that just doesn't work. And those are his two follow-ups to this. He goes at Hollywood, thinks he's going to be a star, and he gets the lead in these two big budget failures.
Yeah.
And then, you know, ends up in finally he ends up in a decent film, in a good film, a film where he gives a great performance, Stop Loss.
Which at that point is a term that could have described what should have happened after Sky High. Just sell now, because the next two movies you make are going to be awful.
And the thing is that he made a movie about coming back from the Iraq War at a time that nobody wanted to watch fucking movies about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
People had war fatigue really bad. And fatigue. Even the Academy Award-winning movie the next year about Iraq couldn't get people in the fucking theaters. Like, yeah. That movie made no fucking money. I think that movie made $15 million domestic.
Isn't that weird to think about now that American Sniper was one of the highest grossing movies of last year?
Well, because the wars are over, and because we don't have war fatigue anymore, and we want to feel like that war, like those wars accomplished something.
It's just a very different sort of,
Go back and watch the actually, you know, the other really good, I don't want to say actually, because I think there's a lot of great stuff in American Sniper. I think the only argument about American Sniper is about the context of the content that it was based on, that the filmmaking is fantastic. But Stop Loss is a good movie that he was in that, you know, nobody saw. And then of course, City Island, another good movie with Ethan Hawke, the that nobody saw. And then by this point, you know, he's, you know, chasing after whatever he can find. And he had missed his window because those two terrible movies torpedoed his entire career. And it's, and yet here, this is his intro moment. And it's this crowning achievement because he's such a great villain. In the first act and a half of this movie, you fucking hate this dude. He glowers and grimaces like nobody's business. Like before you even know much about him, you fucking hate this dude and you're intimidated by him. And then when we see him in the Chinese restaurant and he's being snarky about Will Stronghold, we see why he doesn't like Will Stronghold, and we see him kind of flirting with Danielle Pennebaker. All of a sudden you're like, I like this. Like the instant he's allowed to be human, he's fantastic.
You remember that flower in the Super Mario Brothers games that allowed you to throw fireballs? Imagine if John Bender from The Breakfast Club ate one of those flowers.
Yes, that is exactly who he is.
And then could throw fireballs.
That's, again, he is in another thing that ties these three films together is, you know, that we've talked about. He is that scary badass, like in the, you know, like we talked about last week, that really has a heart of gold and is just misunderstood. He is so very, I guarantee you that this character was taken, you know, woven from it, you know, in total, from whole cloth from Heath Ledger's character in 10 Things I Hate About You. You know, he's that scary guy who really, when you see him, he's like, oh shit, he's not nearly as scary as everybody talks about. He's that kid at school. And yeah, he's very John Bender, who likes to pose a lot to flame up his arms and then throws fireballs at people.
It would have been better if the way he powers up his fireballs would be to raise one fist in the air.
That would have been, don't you forget about me. Don't. Yeah. But he's really good.
Yeah.
That's the thing is.
I look at him and I'm like, why did Taylor Lautner get to have a career when you're the guy that should have been like on that track?
Because he was given the same chance as Taylor Lautner and was put in big films that then flopped.
Ugh.
I mean, that's the thing, is like literally he was in these two truly spectacularly awful movies. That
didn't stop Taylor Lautner. He was in a lot of truly spectacularly bad movies.
Did stop Taylor Lautner. He put out one.
Oh, I'm talking about the Twilight movies.
Well, yeah, but the Twilight movies were going to be hits no matter what.
No matter how shitty they were.
But I you know, the moment Taylor Lautner, you know, what was it, abandoned?
Abducted. Which I always made fun of because it was abducted.
Abducted.
And it was abysmal. And kind of abhorrent, as yes. were he and his father.
And yeah, and that movie tanked, and his career, that was it.
He just had a direct-to-video parkour movie that came out that I had to review that was just like, oh, you sad sack. But yeah, no, I am entirely with you. I think Stephen Strait got raw into the deal, and I would have loved to have seen him in more stuff like this.
And I hope he has a resurgence. You know, this type of thing happens. You have actors that have that moment and then fade away and then come back when they're a little older. And everybody's like, oh, dude, you were War and Peace. I fucking love you. And totally forget, oh, dude, you were that guy in The Covenant. And oh, shit, you were the caveman in 10,000 BC.
Hopefully those movies are not remembered as he works his way through his career.
Oh, there's at least one dude who remembers those movies very fondly.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here with him.
Yes, you are. The Covenant. We got to talk about The Covenant.
Oh, man.
You know what?
Which, please.
I just lost 35 pounds. I can now fit into my old Covenant shirt again.
Oh, that's
terrible. I can start wearing my Covenant t-shirt.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. I hope you gain that weight back. Yeah, I mean...
Boo!
I'm sorry, dude.
Oh, that was cold.
If you were only losing weight to fit into your Covenant t-shirt...
I was not. I just was realizing I can wear my Covenant t-shirt again.
All right, fine. All right.
I'll be the guy wearing a Covenant t-shirt.
So one of the things, God damn it! one of the things that also,
any of you out there who thinks I'm joking about my Covenant t-shirt,
not he is terrifyingly not. Anyway, one of the things that also ties up the three movies we've talked about these last 3 weeks is soundtracks. Now,
oh, yes,
what's really interesting about this movie is that once again, you know, we've mentioned that these films are all very much beholden to the great teen comedies of the 80s. This movie takes it to such a level that its entire soundtrack almost is covers of classic 80s songs.
There are a couple movies that did this. We didn't mention some of them because some of them aren't that great. But this was a thing of this era, and this was kind of the end of the era where it was cool. But yeah, there were several movies that did that hired a bunch of modern bands to remake, but this one's really good.
Yeah, I think my favorite is the Christian Burns cover of Everybody Wants to Rule the World, because it's the perfect crossover of, you know, teen 80s stuff and superhero stuff.
Oh yeah,
it's perfect. Like the cover of True by Spandau Ballet, the cover of, there's a car song, I believe. I Melt With You, Bowling for Soup does a version of that.
I'm a huge Bowling for Soup fan.
Yeah.
My wife is probably one of the world's biggest Bowling for Soup fans. Every time they come through town, we go and see them. And they've played that live. We've seen them play that live.
Well, and I'm just seeing this here. Stephen Strait is credited as the performer on The One Thing Leads to Another cover that's on this soundtrack. He sang that song.
Weird.
I had no idea.
Weird.
That is really bizarre. I don't know why.
Why didn't he do the soundtrack for The Covenant?
If you say Covenant one more time.
Covenant!
I will make you my wiatch.
Covenant!
Oh.
I'm going to make you my wiatch.
This movie's good, guys. I want to stick to the topic that this movie that we're talking about, Sky High, is good.
Sky High is not good. Sky High is fantastic.
That's true. That's
it
true.
It is so satisfying.
Yes. And I actually love where it goes. I love the fact that you enter into a situation where all of the adults at the school, who are each themselves superheroes, are rendered completely ineffectual by Royal Pain and Royal Pain's master plan. And it does fall upon not just the students, but specifically the sidekicks to save the day. And it's so much fun to watch.
Well, it's the classic nerd story.
Yeah,
nerds,
exactly.
It's the triumph
of the nerds. It's revenge
of
the nerds.
Yeah.
If the nerds were sidekicks.
But the nerds all have these weird little powers that are just kind of strange and sad, but that they ultimately start learning to use to their own benefit, becoming heroes.
Yeah.
And you know what? One of my favorite things about this movie is I love the final monologue by Michael Angarano, in which he's like, so that's it. That's the story of how my girlfriend became my archenemy, my best friend became my girlfriend, and my archenemy became my best friend.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of like, yeah, that is ultimately every teen film and
yeah.
every comic book wrapped up, and it just wonderfully cinches it up. And I'm so disappointed that it never caught on, because I really wanted to see more out of this. I wanted to see more of these characters. It was a great origin story, and I would have loved to have seen more of Sky High. You know, clearly this was the freshman year of these characters. I would have loved to have seen their sophomore year. I would have loved to have seen them kind of progress through high school and deal with other high school things, or become superheroes in their own right and you know, have to, you know, work out problems together. And man, I wish Stephen Strait had a better career.
Oh, yeah. And you know, I think what's really fascinating is that if you look at the career of Mike Mitchell, who directed this movie?
Yeah.
Sky High is far and away his best film.
Oh yes.
Like it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad what happens to him after this too, because first of all, before this he did Surviving Christmas, so yeah, and before that he did Deuce Bigelow. And then Sky High, it's like, "Oh, that's great. Maybe he'll do more stuff like that." And then Shrek Forever After and Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked. So
he ended up doing things that made lots of money.
Yeah,
that were not really.
It's one of the easiest cases.
Shrek Forever was the movie where even the people who were on board with all the Shrek sequels were like, "I love it. Shut up. These Shrek movies are great." Or like,
But not that one.
Oh, fuck me.
It's just one of the easiest instances I've ever seen of trying to pick a filmmaker's best movie. This is it. This is Mike Mitchell's best movie by far.
And it's so well cast, it's so well acted, it's so well written and put together. Like the only real flaw the movie has is in its attempt at cheesiness, it comes off a little too tongue-in-cheek in style.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not in how it's done. Like, the editing in the movie and all this, and the acting is all fantastic, but there's just something in style that's a little tongue-in-cheek, that seems a little goofy and made for TV at times.
Made for Disney Channel.
Yeah, for Disney Channel at times. That is completely forgiven by everything else. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, so this is stylistically what they wanted, but you can see that had they tonally done it maybe just a little more realistic, a little grittier, and, you know, a little more, you know, less colorful of a palette, if they hadn't have made it every frame look like it was a comic book, like it was four color, you know, then maybe people would have taken it a bit more seriously. But I don't know. I mean, it's just a movie that it's so goddamn good and it's so goddamn perfect at what it tries. It doesn't fail at anything. It just seems that is the only element that seems a little off. But even then, it totally works for what it is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the superheroes are so goofy. The Commander and Jetstream are such over-the-top characters. All the other, you know, the other heroes that are referenced are so silly.
Yeah.
And the concepts are so goofy that you almost have to have it be four color to work like this.
And I think there's a, you know, we talked about Revenge of the Nerds. I think there's a great encapsulated reference to that in the fact that you got the little nebbish kid, the little nebbish ginger who turns into a giant rock monster and is like one of the most powerful heroes at the school.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a total little dweeb, you know? And like, I think just in and of itself, that's such a great, like, not only Revenge of the Nerds reference, but kind of a foreshadowing of exactly what is going to happen by the end of this movie, where very much like, you know, a classic 80s teen movie, you have the outcasts that are kind of the ones that are called upon to come together and rise above like ridiculous odds and be the heroes.
Yeah.
And in this movie, it just makes it a little bit more literal. They're literally heroes. They're at school to learn how to be heroes.
And I love that this movie subverts the genre in a way that only a couple of movies have done. Another teen movie I wanted to talk about that we hopefully will do another teen month eventually, Trojan War, which is an overlooked teen film from the 90s starring Jennifer Love Hewitt.
I don't even know what that is. I literally have never heard of that movie.
You know what? I will have to introduce you to the joys of Trojan War. But essentially it subverts the ducky trope by gender bending it. Here we have the adorable girl next door being the one in love with the boy next door, but she's too afraid to tell him while he's off scoring with the school hottie.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's the flip of Pretty in Pink. And I love it when movies aren't afraid
to
do
that. Pretty in Spandex. It would be this version. Yeah.
Yeah. So, where, you know, she's off with the bad guy, you know, and I'm just here pining for her. And I love it when they play that, when they gender bend that, because, you know, it is one of the more sexist tropes in the, you know, in teen films. But it's always great when it works and you've got the right, when you've got the right chemistry for it. And in Trojan War, you have Jennifer Love Hewitt playing the tomboy and doing it adorably. Here you have Danielle Pennebaker, who is just, she's just got so much charm and charisma.
And in her first role, in her first film.
Yeah, and she's just so fucking charming. And you just love her character, and you just want to smack the guy for not getting it. You're just like, dude, what are you doing? And he's like, but Mary Elizabeth Winstead. It's like,
Yeah, you can kind of forgive him. Yeah,
Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
It's hard to judge him too much for that, I think.
Yeah, once you've seen Death Proof and seen her run around in the cheerleader outfit or seen her in Scott Pilgrim Saves the World, it's kind of hard not to be madly in love with her every time she's on screen.
Agreed.
And it's like, all right, dude, but then it's like, yeah, when in life are you going to be caught between Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Danielle Pennebaker? Oh yes, in a comic book. This is where I'll buy that Michael Anagrano has a chance between these two women.
Yeah.
It's in a comic book movie.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's, and that's the whole thing is you take everything else out of this movie. It's just a lot of fun to watch. Like the action sequences actually done quite well, even as they're going for comedic effect.
Yeah.
They really do plot out a story that you could imagine reading in a comic book and being engaged with.
Yeah.
Which is really great. And you know what? If they had made the next movie, I want to see the other school. I want to see the school for supervillains. I want it, like, because the whole thing about...
Well, she was going to make an academy
right,
for
Right, so by the time the sequel comes around, there needs to be one. And it needs to be fresh out of the gate with its inaugural class, and what are those kids doing, and that's...
What if Sky High is just one region's school, and it's kind of like Hogwarts, where you believe that Hogwarts is the only magic school, and then you find out, oh, wait, no, there's a French school filled with butterflies,
yes.
And then there's a...
filled with butterflies!
And then a crazy fucking Czechoslovakian
Durmstrong.
School.
Durmstrong! Yes, yeah. Yeah, no, that I could have watched that. I could have watched three more of these movies. I could have watched the TV show. Like, I'm really disappointed this didn't take off. And I don't know if it's one of those situations like we've talked about with a lot of other films where it's just the right film, but at the wrong time.
I think that's what this was.
I think maybe if this had come out 2 years earlier, it would have really taken off. Like, if it had been...
Wah, wah.
Yayo, really would have taken flight. But no, it's, you know, it's a lot of fun to watch. The jokes actually work
really well.
And they're peppered in. Like, there's so many little jokes that if you're not paying attention, you don't even catch.
Oh yeah.
And I think it's hilarious.
Yeah. And, I love, you know, speaking of teen films, cause we've talked a little bit, this movie knows its 80s films as well. I mentioned the whole subversion of the Ducky trope. But so then we get a Ducky moment at the end. We get the fucking Ducky moment that they've set up in Pretty in Pink. You know, originally, for those of you that don't know, Pretty in Pink, a little history, Pretty in Pink had a different ending. In fact, the test audience hated the ending. The ending was the ending of Pretty in Pink was the douchebag ends up turning out to be the douchebag, dumps her at the dance, humiliating her, and she ends up going off with Ducky. Audience hated that. So they had to redo it and actually make him, you know, leave his friends and end up go off with Molly Ringwald. And Molly, and then they're like, but what do we do with Ducky? We've set Ducky up this whole time. And so John Hughes brilliantly had this actress who he had a little thing for that had, you know, that he would then use in several movies in small bit parts, a woman named Christy Swanson, who then he has this girl at the dance at the end who waves Ducky over, and Ducky gives us the camera look, the break in the fourth wall, and then, you know, Ducky's on over to her, and Ducky gets the happy ending. And so we have that. So War and Peace gets the Ducky moment. War and Peace, you almost feel like he should hook up with Danielle Pennebaker at one point, that they belong together, and they have a real chemistry. But she ends up going off with Will Stronghold because, you know, that's what happens in this trope. So what does War and Peace get? Oh, War and Peace, his Christy Swanson is the girl who's been freezing everybody through the whole movie. And so he walks up at the dance, they hold hands, and his fire and her ice.
Yes. And just and, like back she intended.
And yes, and it's just such a cute little moment. It's like, it's the Ducky moment. He gets the girl at the dance, and it's the blonde girl. This is the frozen girl throughout the entire movie. The Ilsa is fucking the Christy Swanson character. and I love that. It's just such a cute moment. And this movie, yeah. All of the little comedy bits work. Like I said, there's that the joke I hate myself for laughing at every time is Mr. Medulla going, regrettably, I have made boom boom.
Yes.
And I laugh every fucking time. And it's like, oh God, dude. Okay, it's a kid in the hall. I have to. And it works. Like all of these jokes, Kurt Russell and Kelly Preston, all of those jokes work. And it's just funny all the way through. And it's just everything about this movie fires on all cylinders.
So give it a chance, guys. If you've been avoiding this because you think it looks too kiddie, it's Disney, who cares, whatever. This is a way better movie than you would possibly expect it to be.
It's legit awesome.
And it's legit awesome.
We can't change who he is. Not without dropping him in a vat of toxic waste.
Where will we even find a vat of
toxic?
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. I struggled with this one. But there's
really?
There's a great joke in the movie, if you listen in the cafeteria, where They come over the intercom and say the cafeteria staff would like to ask the sidekicks to stop ordering hero sandwiches. And it's such a dumb little throwaway joke.
Yes.
That made me laugh so hard. And I was like, you know what? A hero sandwich, which is also regionally known as a grinder or a submarine, is delicious. But it's identified mostly just for the bread that's used and the way that it's cut. I mean, it's just a base. Yeah. The ingredients can be as varied and unique as the restaurants that serve them. So,
and a great hero sandwich is a combination of a number of weird different things, which is exactly what this movie is.
And it can be filled with, you know, spicy peppers, something like maybe Warren would appreciate, beef and brawn like Will would get down on, or just the greens of the gardens that would tempt Layla. The hero sandwich is nothing without the hero support. That is to say, the right ingredients to give it its own identity. Hero sandwich, the sky-high junk food pairing. And that is this week's entry into JFC Summer School. We hope you have enjoyed it. Please come back next week for the weirdest movie we are going to talk about by far, The Last American Virgin. But thank you so much for joining us. You can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. Please do use those Amazon links we put up. We really do appreciate that. And you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at on Twitter at Massawyrm, that's MassaWyrm, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Massawyrm.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or my Facebook page, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. You can also find me at oneofus.net, my home away from a home. A lot of great geek podcasts and blogs for every taste. Definitely want to check that out. And yeah, I guess we're going to close this out. You know what? I want to close this out with all of us thinking about the one person who is the glue of Sky High, who really holds everything together.
The Covenant!
God damn it.